We have two matters for oral argument today. But before we begin, let me introduce the panel that will be hearing these two matters. To my left is the Honorable Mike Wallach. To my right is the Honorable Dabney Basil. My name is Wade Birdwell. And we're the panel that will be hearing the two cases today. We understand we have students from Texas Women's University who are interested in maybe asking a few questions after we finish with oral argument. We can't talk to you about the cases that you will be hearing, okay? So we cannot take any questions that are specific to the cases that you will be listening to today. We can take general questions about what we do, how we do it, that type of thing. And we will hear those at the conclusion of the second argument. So if you will call the case.
The court will now call Kevin Ashley Parnell versus the state of Texas.
May it please the court.
Sure.
My name is Steve Myers, and I represent Mr. Kevin Ashley Parnell, who was the convicted murderer in this case. And this case is important. And one of the reasons why it's important is that it deals with Texas constitutional law. In particular, we're talking about Article 5, Section 13. That constitutional provision, written by the framers of the state of Texas, specified that in district court, juries shall consist of 12 persons. And which I find is interesting because if you look at the federal constitution, there is no such provision. There is no such mirror provision. We are not in a situation here where we're asking the court to expand in some sort of floor-ceiling metaphor as to what the rights of the Texas Constitution are. We're not asking the court to be in lockstep with federal precedent or some sort of new federalism type argument. This is a case that involves what the framers of the Texas Constitution meant to say when they held and they wrote for Texas that in district court a jury shall consist of 12 persons. So the question arises in this case when you have one of the jurors, a seated juror, who could not comprehend and understand the English language. Is that a juror? This court in Stilwell versus State made a statement, which I would submit to you as recondite, in that case, the court said that it was the same type of situation. He had a juror who was found after voir dire, seated on the jury, found to be not fluent in speaking or understanding English, to be distinguished from reading and writing English, as we can get into as part of the 3516 reasons.
Are those not interrelated?
I'm sorry?
I mean, they're, I understand the distinction that your briefing makes between literacy and fluency, but are they not interrelated? You can be able to converse in English, for example, or in Spanish, whatever your language is, without being able to either read or write. But for purposes of acting as a juror who has to follow the written charge of the court, okay, and potentially will have to consider written evidence, your ability to at least read should be interrelated with regard to your fluency in terms of your speaking ability. Why should we be making the distinction that you're making?
We should be making the distinction for a couple of reasons. One is the statute, which makes it a challenge for cause, specifically says only read and write. Now, I understand that courts have interpreted that to include fluency, but I would submit that the court's concurring opinion in Vera is correct. Reading and writing and comprehension and fluency in a foreign language are not the same. I took many years of German. I could sit down with a German text and a dictionary and probably translate it. But were I to watch a video or a movie in German, I couldn't follow it. They are two different things.
But in Stillwell, we were following what we viewed as the Court of Criminal Appeals lead from Montoya. So how are we supposed to get out from under that if we view that as binding, which it is obviously binding precedent on us?
I think you get out from under it by distinguishing it. Montoya and the other case you just said.
Stillwell.
Not Stillwell. Montoya and...
Goodwin, yeah, okay.
I'm sorry?
It's all right, go ahead.
Yeah, the case we're talking about. Stillwell was not a capital case. The distinction is Montoya and the other case were capital murder cases wherein the state was seeking the death penalty. And the distinguishing factor is that because of individual voir dire, that non-fluent juror was eliminated. And a jury heard that death penalty case with 12 people who understood English. That's not the case here. And that's what distinguishes this case is you had one juror, Mr. Gonzalez, who for all practical purposes had no clue what was going on in the trial.
But Montoya also has language that says inability to understand English is excludable under 3516A11. I mean, it has that blanket statement in it.
And I agree. I still think that the court needs to revisit Montoya about that and needs to revisit the concepts as to fluidity versus literacy, because I think they are different. And I think that this is a problem that's going to reoccur in the state of Texas. And it's going to reoccur in certain areas of the state more so than others. But this court, not this panel of this court, but this court, I think, invited the problem that occurred here, and that the trial judge, in reading Stillwell, said, well, they're not going to agree to excuse Mr. Gonzalez. If I take him off the jury, I get reversed because of Stillwell. So my only alternative is to leave Mr. Gonzalez on the jury. This court in the Stillwell opinion said, since the exclusion of Sanchez based upon his inability to understand English had been forfeited, the trial court could have allowed Sanchez to remain on the panel, which is what the trial court did in this case. I question the wisdom of that. I question the wisdom of that, and that's why I'm asking the court to revisit that concept.
But trial counsel didn't want, the trial counsel wanted an either or. I mean, it either wanted a motion for mistrial or to leave him on there. I mean, it didn't present the trial court with an option of going forward with 11.
He did not agree to excusing Mr. Gonzalez. And the reason is he couldn't. Were he to do that, he would have waived his client's right to a jury of 12 folks.
His client could have waived it, though. He could have talked to his client about it.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I guess my point would be that I wouldn't know what he talked to his clients about.
Okay, but is that not part of making the record here with regard to what his actual objection is and what he's actually asking the trial court to do here?
I would disagree. In the criminal case context, I don't believe there would be a duty upon the lawyer to put on the record a confidential communication between him and his client about how he wanted to proceed. That's why he had a lawyer.
Well, no, I didn't suggest that he had to do that. I suggest that because you're making an argument that it was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes.
Suggesting that, in fact, he didn't do something his client either wanted or he did do something that his client didn't want to do. And the issue here is whether or not this juror continues to serve. Okay. You're suggesting that he's unilaterally agreeing to this juror continuing to serve when you don't have a record one way or the other whether he consulted with his client or not.
Well, the IAC claim, if I may, is not that. That's not the IAC claim. In Stillwell, this court said that counsel has a duty to inquire of the panel as a whole of their fluency in English. The IAC claim is that, is it, and the issue Is it ineffective assistance of counsel for a lawyer in voir dire to not make a general inquiry of the panel as to whether or not they all not only can read and write English, but are fluent in English? That's the IAC claim here.
Okay, so how, I'm going to switch gears a little bit.
Sure.
How are we to make a determination here that fluency is distinct from literacy? Literacy, you concede in your brief, clearly can be waived, okay?
Yes.
All right. You're saying this isn't literacy, this is fluency. And therefore, it's not something that can be waived unless it's done affirmatively under the circumstances, which it was not done here.
Yes, sir.
Okay. How are we to make a distinction between literacy, which can be waived, and fluency when we get to the issue of what the record shows here, which is he had a degree of fluency? What amount of fluency is going to be effectively disqualifying or disabling? And well, how are we to make that determination? What record are we looking at? And the reason I'm asking that is we have to have some type of limiting principle, because otherwise we're going to end up with motions for new trial every time we turn around with somebody getting some juror on the after the fact to say, well, I didn't really understand what was being said.
Well, I think that the solution for that is what occurred in Serrano versus State. In that case, if you look at it, during voir dire, several jurors brought to the attention of the court that they did not feel like they understood enough English to follow the proceedings. The Court of Appeals in Serrano says, you know, this is coming up a lot, and we have to have some way to distinguish between jurors who are just trying to get out of jury service
right,
versus those who are truly not fluent in English. So in Serrano, what the trial court did is he made a record, because he was given the opportunity to make a record, either by the juror speaking up on their own or the lawyer asking the questions. But he made a record, and there were affirmative findings that in that case the juror understood enough to be fluent. So the solution lies in this court or some court saying, yes, Mr. Trial Lawyer, you have a duty in voir dire to ascertain whether this panel can understand, read, and write English. Failure to do that is what?
But what is the standard of how much is enough in terms of being able to understand?
Well, I think
what objective measurement do you have to use to apply that test?
I think that that's where you have to leave it to the trial judge. In the trial judge's discretion of a colloquy between the potential juror and the court or the lawyers, is this juror evidencing enough comprehension that I can say that they are fluent? That's a decision I would suggest would be made at the trial court level. Now, if there's a record, it certainly could be reviewed on appeal whether or not that record showed enough or not. Now, in this case, you have Mr. Gonzalez.
On appeal, how would you know? Again, it comes back to how much is enough? And are we talking about differences in ability to understand concepts such as reasonable doubt? Or are we talking about being able to understand words? Because you may be able to speak English very well and understand English very well, and you may not have a good understanding of what reasonable doubt means, even in English.
Sorry, and I'm hearing a radio from somewhere. I don't know where it's coming from.
Get your phone again.
But I hope it's not me. If it is, I'll surrender my phone. I'm pretty sure it's not that. I think that that's a good question, and to me it's one such as similar to the competency of a witness. The trial judge is going to make an inquiry as to whether or not the child witness, for example, is competent. Same sort of scenario, but the trial judge has to make that determination. In this particular situation, it was clear Mr. Gonzalez did not understand what beyond a reasonable doubt meant, did not understand what reasonable doubt meant. In this particular case, we're not asking for relief in the form of a remand for...
Is it necessary for him to understand what a reasonable doubt means during the trial as opposed to during deliberations with the court's charge, with the definition in front of him, which he clearly can read based upon his answers to the questionnaire?
I'm sorry, I may have missed the question, but...
The question is, you're saying he didn't understand what reasonable doubt was.
Right.
Okay. And I'm just saying, that little colloquy with the court and with counsel, why does that matter whether he understood what the concept, the legal concept of reasonable doubt meant at that very moment, when in fact the only real question was whether he was going to be able to understand it when he was given the instructions from the court with regard to what that meant, and whether he would be able to appropriately deliberate with the other members of the jury with regard to that. He clearly was going to be able to read it, because everything in that colloquy with regard to his answering the questionnaire, his being able to look up the definitions of words he didn't understand in the questionnaire on his own and figure out what was going on. There was no indication in voir dire that his questionnaire answers were in any way, shape, or form giving any type of hint that he had no clue what he was talking about. He didn't answer a question going, oh, I thought it meant A, and then answered it like it meant B. Everything that was in front of all counsel and the court through voir dire indicated he understood what was going on. So the fact that he later says, well, I don't really, I'm a little bit doubtful on the issue of reasonable doubt, doesn't necessarily matter until he actually is given those instructions. Nobody asked him whether or not he could understand it for purposes of deliberations.
Nope, nobody asked him really any question. The one question that he was asked, he told the record that I have no opinion, because I think the record shows he didn't understand what the question had to do with. But as to, you know, for one thing, you're not given an instruction of reasonable doubt, obviously. So you have to have some concept or understanding of what that term means. But I think the real issue is not so much with his understanding concepts and terms, is that he indicated after the first day of testimony, he came back at the end of that day, he told the bailiff, I can't follow what people are saying. They say a lot of words, and I catch one, and then I'm lost. So it's more of a concept of his, or a problem is of his ability to understand witness testimony in the proceedings. He could read and write, even if he had to go to a Google dictionary and look up the answers to the questionnaire, but that's different from being able to follow along in a conversation, which he obviously could not do.
Okay. Counsel, thank you. If you will give counsel an additional minute, please.
Counsel. May it please the court?
Sure.
Counsel? In regards to point of error one, unless the court has any specific questions about it, the state will rely on its brief and just remind the court that any questions about the qualifications are waivable if not brought up during voir dire, which they were not.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the concurrence in Vera relies on one Supreme Court case, one Court of Criminal Appeals case, 1874 and 1916, both of which, at least from the parenthetical citation, appear to say that having somebody on a jury who does not understand English requires a reversal and back to the trial court for a new trial. What were the circumstances that caused the two high courts that were responsible for criminal matters at the time to do that?
In all honesty, I'm not familiar with those cases.
Okay. Here's my real question is, the right to jury trial requires a jury that can consider the evidence and has the capacity to deliberate with 11 other members of the jury. Okay. Does that mean they're going to catch everything? No. Does it mean they're going to understand everything? No. But it at least means they have to have the ability to understand the evidence that's being presented, either verbally or in writing, so that when they do get in and they to follow the court's instructions with regard to deliberations, they can have a meaningful participation with regard to deliberations. If they cannot understand English, they cannot understand if all 11 other members of the jury speak English and they're going to conduct deliberations in English, then that is an individual who is not going to be able to conduct, to deliberate in any meaningful sense.
Sure.
And that seems to me to violate
Well, I think maybe we're...
Violate the right to a jury trial under those circumstances on its face, because you're not getting 12 people doing a deliberation. So I'm trying to figure out, we do have Montoya, we do have Stillwell. Now we've been had these two cases previously that have been cited by the concurrence in Vera that now raise this issue that if, in fact, it's conclusively proven that they cannot deliberate, then it's got to go back because you have to have a full jury for purposes of deliberation.
Okay, well, I would say that it wasn't conclusively proven. Every communication that Mr. Gonzalez had with the court was in English. He spoke to the court in English. He responded to questions in English. He wrote in English. He read English. There was no way that anybody could have known. And by the way, I don't think it was established that he was, that he wasn't fluent in English. I don't think that was established at all. He claimed it. He claimed it. And if you look at his claim, he says, well, I didn't know I was, I'm paraphrasing obviously,
I didn't know I was going to have to be here a
second day.
Yeah.
So he thought he was going to be fine for a day. What changed? Well, what's a common complaint about jury duty?
We don't have anything in the record to indicate that the judge considered his explanation to be any type of shirking. That is a consideration. Counsel brought that up. Obviously, people sometimes don't want to be on jury duties if they think they can actually say something that will keep them off of a jury or get them off of a jury, they will do so. But there's nothing in this record that indicates that that's what the trial court thought was going on here.
True, and there's nothing to indicate that the trial court didn't think that. And I know that's a silly answer, but the thing about it is the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove that something went wrong. And I don't think that's happened here. Under Texas law, the qualifications are waivable if they're not brought up in voir dire. And that's exactly what the trial court told the defendant, or excuse me, trial counsel. It's like, look, you can't challenge the qualifications once that jury is seated. You can't do it. And that's under Texas law, and it's perfectly sound. But not only that, appellant hasn't preserved this issue. When the court said, because basically what he's saying, or if I remember the brief correctly, is that they should have gone on with 11 in the first point of error. And the court said, listen, if you want to make the objection that he's disabled, I'll listen to it. And I think he indicated that we would go on with 11. And trial counsel specifically said, no, that is not my objection. My objection is simply he's not qualified to be on this jury. I want a mistrial. Well, he can't do that after the jury is seated.
And there's a legal distinction. There's a legal distinction between disqualification and disability. So,
yes, there is.
Do you agree with the concurrence in Vera that the inability to speak, if we assumed it was a constitutional disqualification, are you saying that's waivable except unless the defendant agrees in writing or there's affirmative consent that's agreed to by the state?
I'm saying that doesn't apply here because it's never been conclusively established that Mr. Gonzalez can't understand English. Again, every communication he had with the court was in English. Every communication. He spoke to the court in English. He wrote to the court in English.
I have a question that you'll need to answer as well, okay? And this question is, okay, how is a trial court or a challenging attorney or a supporting attorney supposed to question a juror who's in the box about their understanding of the evidence without accidentally getting into their deliberations and their impressions with regard to the evidence? That may be one of the reasons why it's waivable up front, is because in order for a trial court to determine whether or not an in-the-box juror is actually understanding the proceedings, he has to question the juror about the proceedings, in which case he is starting to invade the province of the jury at that point in time, which he can't do.
I don't see that that would be workable at all. And I think you kind of hit it on the head there. That is why it's waivable. You need to suss it out during voir dire. I'm sorry. Are there any more questions regarding point of error one? Then we'll move on to the IAC claim. Any time we get one of these on direct appeal, our immediate reaction is that record isn't developed enough, and that's the same reaction we have with this one. The record just isn't developed. Court of Criminal Appeal requires proof of ineffectiveness to be firmly grounded in the record, and this court, I did a search today, there were 150, just under 150 cases where this court has said in one way or another, we will not infer ineffectiveness. And this simply means that there's no supposition, no speculation, no inference, no filling in the blanks. It's got to be in the record. Now, under Strickland, I don't know the exact language, so I'm going to paraphrase. We know the two prongs of Strickland. One is that counsel did something that a competent lawyer wouldn't do. And then two is, but for that, there would have been different results. Before trial, there was a hearing on the juror questionnaire, and defense counsel made it very clear that he was concerned about the racial bias aspect of the case. He even asked that a question be taken off the questionnaire because he didn't want the jury focused on racial bias before they heard any evidence. During voir dire, the state hammered racial bias. That phrase came up about a dozen times. Now, a lawyer that has a client who is accused of a hate crime would naturally want to de-emphasize, or at least reasonably want to de-emphasize, the racial bias aspect, and probably would want to sidestep any issue that might make his side appear bigoted or xenophobic. Now, appellant even in his brief argues that excluding a juror due to language fluency is akin to excluding a juror based on race. And that's a reasonable position to take. Now, if it's reasonable for appellate counsel to take that position, I think it should also be reasonable for defense counsel to take that position. And trial counsel could have been trying to avoid a Batson challenge by not bringing that up. It's possible, but we don't know because the record is undeveloped as far as that issue is concerned. Now, appellant could have developed the record, but he skipped the procedural safeguard of a hearing on a motion for new trial. That is exactly what this is set up to do, is to develop the record so we can make these decisions, so a fact finder can make these decisions. Instead, he's putting it in front of this court with an undeveloped record, and that, frankly, that shouldn't be rewarded. Now, as far as harm under Strickland, quote, it is not enough for the defendant to show that the errors had some conceivable effect. Again, that's just a fancy way of saying you got to show actual harm here. And if you look at appellant's harm argument, he says that because the jury rejected his sudden passion defense, which they're allowed to do, he was likely harmed by Mr. Gonzalez's presence. And he goes on to support this by saying if Mr. Gonzalez did not understand certain legal concepts, he wouldn't have understood the mitigation evidence. Likely and if, those are two qualifiers. Those are qualifiers that have absolutely no place in a Strickland analysis. Again, it's got to be firmly grounded in the record, no filling in the blanks. So we don't know if Mr. Gonzalez didn't understand the mitigation evidence because we haven't heard that from him. Again, this could have been developed in a hearing on a motion for new trial. And I would also point out that the jury unanimously rejected his sudden passion defense. It wasn't one person. They weren't hung up on it. There were no notes sent about it. It was unanimous. Every person. They were asked about it. They were polled about it. And Mr. Gonzalez said, when he was asked if this is his verdict, he said, yes, it is. Now, it is possible that appellant was harmed. But possible is not good enough for this court to make a determination of ineffective counsel. And as I said before, the argument is speculative. It says that he was likely harmed if the following facts, fill in the blank, are true. But it's not on the record whether Mr. Gonzalez misunderstood the mitigation evidence. And appellant's argument requires this court to assume that that any misunderstanding favored the state. We don't know that. We got to develop the record. And that's why these issues are better taken on in motions for new trial and in writ procedures. And then, are there any questions so far regarding the IAC? And just as a way to kind of wrap this up, in appellant's brief, he informs us that the Texas legislature actually considered and rejected fluency requirements for jurors. And now he's asking this court to punish an officer of the court for not following a law that the legislature considered and rejected. I find it to be inappropriate. Are there any questions regarding points of error 1 or 2? And I will thank the court for its time and be seated.
Thank you.
Let me address that last point first. My good friend, I think, misreads my brief. The legislature rejected an amendment to the statute inserting the word English. As it says right now, it says inability to read and write. It doesn't use the word English. So it's always been thought, well, maybe they must have meant English. But that's what the legislature rejected. They did not reject fluency. That was never brought
really
to the legislature's attention.
Isn't really what you're talking about here more of a due process concept, okay? That in fluency is a part of it, but really and truly it's a capacity to understand the evidence and to deliberate with your fellow jurors with regard to that evidence to reach a verdict. That's really the only thing that's required here, okay? Because there are things that jurors hear and see that nobody else on the panel sees, okay? And that gets brought to the deliberation by that particular juror when deliberations begin. So the only real question is not whether somebody's necessarily completely 100% fluent. It's whether or not they're sufficiently fluent that they can, in fact, understand the evidence or deliberate with regard to that evidence when given the opportunity going back into the jury room. So the fact whether or not the legislature included English or not, okay, the fact remains that most juries have a common English communication basis, okay? Mm-hmm. Technically, there would be absolutely nothing wrong with a jury going back and deliberating in Spanish if every one of them were sufficiently conversant in Spanish to do so, okay? Mm-hmm. So isn't that really what you're complaining about? But let's get back to the question I needed you to answer, which is, okay, how do we investigate the fluency degree of the juror once in the box?
In the box.
Without potentially doing serious damage by influencing the jury, you know, and essentially you're getting into the mind of that juror as to what they're hearing, what they consider the evidence to be, mm-hmm. and you're giving counsel and potentially the court to mm-hmm. correct things mm-hmm. they shouldn't be having conversations with the jurors about in the middle of the trial. So how do we do that? Okay, how do we do that?
I'm going to answer that probably with an I don't know, but let me go back and first
that's
I appreciate
well, that's
your
fair.
I appreciate
that might be the answer.
I appreciate your direction of the due process. Although I would add to it, I believe it's an equal protection claim as well, in the broader context. But to answer your question, of course, the options are for the trial judge to say, well, as he did in this case, you bring that juror out separately, you question them outside the presence of the other jurors. Could you question them outside the presence of the lawyers? Perhaps. Is there anything that says you can't?
This isn't like undue outside influence where you can bring them in and ask them specifically about things that are occurring outside the jury room, and then maybe all you do is ask the other jurors whether or not that information had been brought into the jury room, yes or no, kind of thing. This is actually asking them to, what is it about the, and that may be why we have the record we have. Judge Gallagher may not have been wanting to ask, well, what did you not understand?
Fair comment. And would have been
by doing that, you're getting information from a juror and interfering potentially with their deliberations.
I don't disagree, and I don't know what the necessary answer to that is. Let me, if I can speak briefly as to this preservation issue.
One last question.
Sure.
And that, don't you almost have to be able to do this during voir dire, because otherwise you're going to be getting into trial after trial after trial on the second day, third day, fourth day. Well, I really don't understand what's going on. I don't understand. I don't speak English well enough to follow. I mean, that's something that almost has to be done during voir dire. Otherwise, you're going to have chaos.
My point exactly, which is why I would like this court to tell TCDLA, tell the prosecutors' associations, and tell the state bar educations that we all go to, that you've got a duty in voir dire to make sure these jurors can understand, read, and write English.
Well, but that's different because you don't know who the makeup of every panel is and what the answers to the questionnaires and answers to the questions that are being asked. You may have a person who appears to be Hispanic, and they're answering questions perfectly well in English, that you don't need to ask those questions. So you're trying to come up with a blanket requirement on something which may not be necessary.
Well, that's, this court in Stilwell said that. You've got a duty to inquire. That's what this court said in Stilwell. Not this panel, obviously, but that's what this court said.
But why shouldn't there be just some type of reasonable trigger for that duty to inquire? Otherwise, you're asking for a blanket, go down the veneer and ask everybody, do you understand the words coming out of my mouth? Which could actually end up making most of those people very upset with you if they end up on the jury.
Perhaps, but legislatively, perhaps the fix is you've got a requirement that they inquire, that the trial judge inquire about three things, right? Three things only does the trial judge have to inquire about in voir dire. Are you a resident of this county? Have you ever been convicted of a felony or a crime of moral turpitude? Are you under indictment for a crime of moral turpitude? Answers to those could be just as embarrassing, but those are the only three questions a trial judge is required to ask. Why not add a fourth? Are you fluent in English? Can you read and write?
But that fixes me above our pay grade.
Well, I think it's below your pay grade, but the point is that we see many opinions where perhaps the court could lend direction to the legislature on that issue. And would get us out of this problem.
Let me refocus you for a second.
Sure.
Judge Wallach may have lied to you about that being the last question.
I can stay as long as the court likes.
I mean, the resolution in the concurrence in Vera was exactly what he was discussing. Basically, determined the trial judge didn't believe that the juror actually was not fluent in English.
True.
Why isn't that a solution in this case?
I think because the record is clear enough that this juror, if you compare the two records and you look at the record in this case, Mr. Gonzalez, yes, he was replying in English, but if you look at the English he used to reply to the questions, it's clear he's not understanding English and he's not fluent in it.
And with respect to your IAC claim, weren't there sound strategic reasons for counsel not to go into the questions you wanted him to ask concerning the nature of the charges in this case?
My response is no. What trial lawyer would ever, in good faith and honesty, ever want to put a juror on the jury who could not understand the proceedings? And it could have been followed up easily with a juror who was sitting right next to Mr. Gonzalez, who, sua sponte, raised her hand and says, I don't understand enough to participate. How hard would it have been to have a follow-up question? Anybody else like Ms. Whoever here? How hard would that have been? And the fact that there was no sound strategy is indicated by the fact he kept arguing about it and moved for a mistrial. But the key to this whole case lies not in the original colloquy about the objection, disqualification, disability. It goes into the last part of the record where his constitutional argument objection is made.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
All right, the case is submitted. We thank y'all.
Thank you, Judge.